Good afternoon, you are tuned in to KTUO and KRNN FM in Juneau here on Friday the 27th of May, year 2017. Jeff Ryan with you today. We'll be talking with musician BJ Lederman about the theme for the morning edition and his first CD. We'll get details about Saturday's Audubon Birdwalk, find out about summer camps at the Zanker News Center, that Writer's Almanac, music, more live on Juneau Afternoon. Also find out why the whale statue is where it is. With the forecast for tonight, areas of fog after 1 a.m., otherwise partly cloudy skies. Forecast for Saturday, areas of fog before 10 a.m. Forecast for Sunday, mostly sunny skies with high temperatures near 67 degrees.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Educators are worried about the status of various Native American programs for K-12 students following President Trump's latest budget plan, as KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
A New York Times analysis says Indian education would lose nearly $2 billion over a 10-year period if the president's budget is approved in its current form. This would affect reservation schools and education programs that teach about Native American culture, such as the Eugene 4J District's Natives Program. Brenda Brainerd is its director. She says about 1,200 students participate every year.
The Indian Ed program has been here since 1972. Our data shows that as a result of our ability to keep students engaged in their culture, that students are staying more engaged in school. The statewide assessment tests are actually creeping up a little. We're still struggling at the 8th and 5th grade math levels, but they have been steadily creeping up.
Brainerd says besides the proposed budget, other factors affecting Indian education funding could include a government shutdown if Congress can't reach a new budget deal by October. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
A Lakota artist is bringing her work back home to the Plains after working on the East Coast. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jackie Hendry reports.
A local artist is returning from New York for upcoming exhibits. Renelle White Buffalo is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. She grew up in South Dakota and moved to New York City to pursue a career in art. She says the upcoming exhibit at the Sioux Indian Museum in Rapid City features paintings created during a recent residency in Wyoming.
I knew that I would have a connection there, but I didn't realize how, like, deep of a connection that I would have, like, that I did have there. And I just drew a lot of inspiration from there, and it reminded me of South Dakota, but it also, like, made me miss New York. And so everywhere I go, I find, I don't know, a new inspiration, and I think that helps a lot as an artist.
The opening at the Sioux Indian Museum is Friday. White Buffalo's work is also set to appear in a group exhibit at Rapid City's Journey Museum in June. For National Native News, I'm Jackie Hendry.
The Navajo Nation Council approved legislation this week to request the state of New Mexico honor leader Chief Manuelito. The honor would be the designation of U.S. Route 491 as Chief Manuelito Highway. The highway stretches nearly 200 miles from Utah to New Mexico and crosses a number of Navajo communities. Navajo lawmakers say the designation would recognize the chief and history of the Navajo people. Chief Manuelito was a leader in the 1800s before and after the Long Walk. He negotiated and advocated for Navajo people to return to their traditional homelands from a government camp in New Mexico. The highway has been worked on since 2008 for improvements. Construction is scheduled to be finished by September. U.S. Senator John Hoeven, chair of the Indian Affairs Committee, introduced legislation Thursday to address tribal housing needs. The bill would streamline the federal process for developing housing projects on Indian land and give tribes more control over the development of those projects. It also reauthorizes programs under the Native American Housing Assistance and Self-Determination Act, which includes block grant and loan guarantee programs. According to Hoeven's office, the legislation is based on consultation from tribes, tribal housing authorities, and national and federal groups. The Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians voted Thursday to remove its leader, the Associated Press reports. The tribal council found Principal Chief Patrick Lambert guilty on a dozen articles of impeachment, alleging he used his position for personal gain. Lambert was elected leader of the North Carolina tribe in 2015 and called the impeachment effort a witch hunt for his move to audit tribal programs. This is reportedly only the second time a chief has been removed from office since the early 1800s. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
That is support by the Albuquerque Hispanic Chamber of Commerce Convention and Tourism Department, providing complete convention and visitor planning services to Native American conventions. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org.
Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for more than 30 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
The sound of millions of America's people across the country and around the world wake up to. And as a company of credit, our theme music is composed by B.J. Lederman. I thought to myself, who is B.J. Lederman and what does his music sound like? Therefore, I was amazed to receive recently a copy of B.J. Lederman's first CD, simply titled B.J. I'm honored to have as my first guest the musician himself, Mr. B.J. Lederman. B.J., welcome to June Afternoon. As my first guest, the musician himself, Mr. B.J. Lederman. B.J., thanks for coming on the show with me today.
Thanks for having me. That song sounds familiar, even all the way from Alaska.
You're in North Carolina now. Is that where you're from?
I'm from Virginia Beach, Virginia, from the Hampton Roads area, but I've been living in Asheville, not Nashville, but Asheville, North Carolina, for about the past 5 to 6 years now.
Have you ever visualized millions of listeners you have through Morning Edition and other themes you've provided for NPR?
I try to visualize them. I'm trying to visualize them right now as I send my first album out into the, you know, into the stores and stuff. I hope they're visualizing me. It's been a wonderful long ride with NPR with the theme music, and this is kind of a Hail Mary pass to. It seems like a second career, but actually it's my first love, you know, pop and rock and roll.
Besides Morning Edition, there's Weekend Edition, Marketplace, Science Friday. Wait, don't tell me. Did I miss anything?
The Stump the Chumps theme from Car Talk and Marketplace, Weekend Edition, Morning Edition. There are a few more that I did in between that came and went, but those are the biggies, I think.
How did all this come about?
Well... It came about when I opened my big mouth about 30 years ago and told all my friends that, you know, I was working on an album. And I actually started writing some of these songs 25 or 30 years ago. And some of them are as recent as 1 or 2 years ago. And I was all talk because I was more or less busy enjoying my life. And when I got to Asheville, I hooked up with some fabulous musicians here, and they, you know, we gigged, we played some shows at various places in Black Mountain and Asheville. And during that process, they helped me get these songs together and form the originals. And then I bumped into a producer from L.A. who had just moved here, who's responsible for a lot of pretty well-known material in his day. His name is Eric Serafin. He goes by the moniker Mixer Man. And he didn't have a project, and he knew who I was, and he said, well, let's get going. So we went down to Athens, Georgia, and got the Randall Bramlett Band, and they came up to Echo Mountain Studios in Asheville, and we laid the rhythm tracks down and went back to Nashville when I met Bela Fleck, and he agreed to be on three of these instrumentals that I wrote a long time ago that are on this album. So we managed to put it together.
How did the gig with Morning Edition theme music come along?
That was a perfect storm situation of being in the right place at the right time. I was going to college at American University in Washington, D.C., and I had a friend, Skip Peasy, who was in the engineering department at NPR, and they were kicking around the idea of a new morning news show. In fact, they kicked it around and actually did some pilots of the show, and they got to a point where they realized they needed a theme. And I had been doing jingles for most of my musical life, commercials and jingles, and I had given a cassette tape of these jingles to Skip, and he had given it to one of the producers, the first producer of the show. And so when they realized that they needed a theme, Skip was asked to get in touch with me, and I was brought in.
How many versions of the theme are there?
Oh, Lord, Morning Edition. I think we did three, if not four, separate trips back to the studio over the years. Back in the day, NPR used to, you know, be in the habit of going back and freshening up theme music every 3 to 5 years or so. With the same thing with Weekend Edition, I did two versions for Weekend Edition. But the best thing that happened to me the second time that I went into the studio to freshen up Morning Edition, they put me together with an arranger by the name of Jim Pugh, who in New York was an A-list trombonist for recording sessions and jingles and even, you know, Broadway show albums and stuff like that. And he's a fabulous arranger, and so he arranged the second package of Morning Edition. And in fact, everything you hear of mine on public radio that has an orchestra in it, it's Jim's work. And it's just cool for me to mention that Jim has been playing with Steely Dan, one of my favorite bands and influences, for I don't know what now, a decade, close to a decade, and been on their last handful of albums. So I think it's really great.
What's the process of making a jingle or a theme music?
You know, the secret to that really is writing something that's simple enough that you can sort of plant an earworm, is what we call it, in people's heads that they, you know, might find themselves subconsciously whistling or humming without it being grating on their nerves, you know, with the idea that they may be hearing this, say, every day or, you know, once a week or 5 days a week for a long, long time. And it's got to wear well. And that's what I think, I'm very fortunate. I think most of my themes have worn well, at least the ones that haven't been replaced up to now.
Have you ever performed your radio themes in a formal setting, like a concert venue?
Yeah, in fact, one of those was Alaska in Anchorage with the World Youth Orchestra. And I've done it with a few other orchestras under the baton of Jung Ho Park. Two or three times in San Diego. It's the first time I've ever done something like that, and I hope to be able to do it again with Jung Ho and travel to different public radio towns and cities. And, you know, in addition to doing my rock stuff, you know, showing up on a different night with the orchestra, or maybe in part of the same show. But it's such a thrill to be up there on stage surrounded by an orchestra, you know, beating the devil out of a grand piano, playing your own themes. It's something that I never thought I would live to do, but I got it done.
How many instruments do you play?
I play keyboard and drums, and so you know, with keyboard now, the samplers and synthesizers and everything else, you can pretty much emulate every instrument of the orchestra and then some. But my favorite is drums. I'd rather be bashing on the drums than anything. And I think I actually picked up the drums in my childhood first before I actually sat down with any seriousness on the piano.
Why did you wait so long to put out your first CD?
Because I'm stupid. I don't know. I think I was, I never took myself seriously as a singer-songwriter. I was in bands. I was playing cover tunes in bands as we toured the country, and we played stuff like, you know, Side Two of Abbey Road, that beautiful medley from Here Comes the Sun all the way through to the end. And we'd play medleys by Moody Blues and Steely Dan, and we played Tommy by The Who. That's dating myself, I think. But, you know, we had a lead singer. And I guess I just got psyched out and went, you know, okay, he's this lead singer. You're not. And we did end up doing a handful of my material in the course of the couple of bands that I toured with. But I don't know. I would sit in the audience and watch Billy Joel, you know, on his Piano Man tour and go, man, that's thrilling. He's a killer. And I would actually, you know, open some of our shows with Angry Young Man, which is one of Billy Joel's hardest to play songs, I think, on the piano. And we pretty much killed it. But I never really thought that, hey, man, I could do that until later in life. And it was just a matter of taking a deep breath and going, okay, you're putting your heart and your soul out there now. You know, do the best you can. It doesn't have to be perfect. That's it. I was trying to be perfect. And so it took 30 or so years to convince myself to stop trying to be perfect. Just do the best you can and get it out there.
Are you planning on touring with the new album? You've got a large fan base built in thanks to public radio.
Yeah, I do. I do plan to put a tour together. That's the next step for us to do, is to contact the public radio member stations and the general managers, see who's interested in a visit, and put together, you know, two or three different legs of a tour, and come out and help the public radio stations raise some of the funds that they need to raise every year. I don't know if a lot of the audience is aware of this, but some of the, you know, most of the big shows come with hefty fees. All Things Considered doesn't run for free, neither does Morning Edition or Weekend Edition. So hopefully I can come out and, you know, we can all get together in a big place and have a great time and rock and roll and raise some funds for the member stations.
What do you think you'd better be known for, your Morning Edition music or your original tunes?
Wow. That's the first time I've ever been asked that. Good shot. Well, you know, I think that I've come to terms with the idea. I'm in my 60s now. I'm 61. And it's so incongruous to see me on stage, you know, with a silvery beard, with a rock and roll band screaming like John Lennon and beating the hell out of a piano. I've come to terms with the idea that I think some, if not all, of this theme music might outlive me. And that's kind of cool. You know, I've had more than my 15 minutes of light shown on me, you know, from the public radio themes. But there are a few songs in this album that have messages that come directly from my heart that I decided it would be okay to put on this album and to try to keep moving, you know, the country and the world in a positive direction. It might get me into trouble, who knows, but I finally got the strength to say, put it on there and put it out. And, you know, it doesn't take a hero. Anybody can do it.
I'm talking with B.J. Lederman, who's composed the music for Weekend Edition, Morning Edition, Marketplace, Science Friday. Wait, don't tell me. It's the Stumper on Car Talk. I want to thank you for being on air with me today. Maybe you'll make it to Juneau sometime.
All I need is an invitation. You know my name. Look up the number. Thanks. It's been great.
Thanks a lot, BJ.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 26th of May, 2017. It was on this date in 1521 that Martin Luther was declared an outlaw. His writings were banned by the Edict of Worms, which made Luther more of a hero than he already was, and a big reason that Protestantism caught on so quickly. It was on the eve of All Saints' Day 4 years before that he nailed to the door of the Wittenberg Church 95 theses attacking the sale of indulgences and other excesses of the Catholic Church. On his trip to Worms for the assembly, Luther was celebrated as a hero in most of the towns he passed, and after the edict was handed down, he refused to recant, and he went back to Wittenberg to start the Reformation. It's the birthday of the jazz trumpeter Miles Davis, 1926, Alton, Illinois, grew up in East St. Louis. His family was fairly well off. His father was a dental surgeon. The family had a ranch in Arkansas. Miles Davis moved to New York, 1944, studied at Juilliard, did jam sessions with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. He formed a nine-piece ensemble of the late 1940s, which recorded the music that went into the album Birth of the Cool, 1957, which heralded the beginning of the cool jazz movement. And it's the birthday of the photographer Dorothea Lange, born in Hoboken, New Jersey, 1895, traveled the country taking pictures at the beginning of the Great Depression. Most famous photograph, Migrant Mother, Napomo, California, 1936. Dorothea Lange, who said, "So often photography is just sticking around and being there." Here's a poem for today by Rebecca McClanahan, "Watching My Parents Sleeping Beside an Open Window Near the Sea." Needing them still, I come when I can, this time to the sea where we share a room, their double bed, my single. Morning fog paints the pale scene even paler, lace curtains breathing, the chenille spread folded back, my father's feet, white sails furled at the edge of blue pajamas. Every child's dream, a parent in each hand, though this child is 50. Their bodies fit easily with room to spare. When did they grow so small, as if it were possible to swell backwards into an earlier self? On the bureau, their toys and trinkets, his shaving brush and pink heart pills, her gardenia sachet, the tiny spindle that pricks the daily bubble of blood, her sweet chemistry. Above our heads, a smoke alarm pulses, its red eye beating. One more year, I ask the silence. Last night, to launch myself into sleep, I counted their breaths, the tidal rise and fall. I now put my ear to the coiled shell of their lives. Watching My Parents Sleeping Beside an Open Window Near the Sea, a poem by Rebecca McClanahan from Deep Light, New and Selected Poems, used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Home Advisor, matching homeowners with background check professionals for home projects from minor repairs to major remodels. See homeowner reviews, compare prices, and book appointments at homeadvisor.com. And by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, now available on iOS devices. Subscriptions available at poetrymagazine.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's 26 minutes past the hour, and you are tuned into Juneau Afternoon. Our next guest is Brenda Wright, who's on the board of the Juneau Audubon Society, here to talk about the bird walk scheduled for Saturday. Brenda, thanks for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff.
Tell me a little bit about the Audubon Society first, please.
Well, we're an organization that would like to think that if we help protect bird habitat, and that helps protect wildlife habitat, and that protects people habitat. So our interest in birds is really broad. We want to make it the best as possible world for both birds and people.
About how many members do you have?
Well, you know, overall, because we have about 200 in town, but we send out letters and electronic newsletters to about 400 members, because it covers most of Southeast Alaska.
You're talking here today about Saturday's bird walk. What time does it start?
It starts at 8 o'clock, and this week it's going to be at Sheep Creek. But I just did want to make sure I can mention twice that our bird walks are going to continue for another 3 weeks after tomorrow, and they're always on Saturday, and they're always at 8 o'clock.
How long do they last?
You know, it's up to the individual people, depending on where we have the one. Tomorrow's at Sheep Creek, at the bridge, at the estuary part of Sheep Creek. So if you come out there and you feel like walking out a ways and seeing as many birds as possible, you can leave in a half hour, hour or two. It's up to you.
What birds are you expecting to see?
Well, hopefully we'll get to see some more shorebirds that have been passing through for about a month now, and some ducks, and hopefully some other interesting things that will be flying by so we can observe them.
What should people wear or bring?
Well, the best thing to do for sure when you're walking on a tide flat is to wear boots. And since it's going to be beautiful, maybe you should bring sunglasses. But please, no dogs.
Anything else you want to bring up about the Audubon Society?
Well, I'd like to go ahead and mention the other ones coming up, if that's all right.
Perfect.
All right, so Saturday, June 3rd, it's going to be at Sandy Beach, Treadwell. Everybody knows where that is, where Sandy Beach starts. And the leader of that's going to be Gus Van Vliet. And so you need to park at the Sabico parking lot at the end. And that's going to be a great one for flycatchers and thrushes and warblers. It's just a really great habitat with all that great mixture of trees back there. And then Saturday, June 10th at 8 a.m., it's going to be Moose Lake. And we'd like people to park by the Mendenhall Bridge at 8 a.m. And Jeff Sauer will be the leader there. And please wear boots for that also, because he's going to try and reach Norton Lake, which is a little bit more difficult to get to than Moose Lake. But they'll be walking around looking for warblers again, and the things that we hardly see here, the northern warbler and red starts and things that are very rare in town.
Well, but what about the binoculars?
Yes. Well, we do have binoculars. If you don't happen to have some, because this is for all ages and skill levels, we'll have some free binoculars that you can use during the walk. But if you have some, please bring them. Ours are all waterproof, and it's going to be sunny every time, right? Our last walk for birds is going to be June 17th, also at 8 a.m., but at Point Bridget. And Gus Van Vliet will also be leading this walk. And that's going to be a long walk. It'll be over at least a mile to get to the good viewing areas for birds there. And the wildflowers will probably be quite gorgeous by that time, too.
When people are buying a set of binoculars, should they go for the monocular or the binocular? And about how much should they expect to pay for a good...
It's really remarkable what a nice pair of binoculars you can get for under $100 now. But the most important thing for here is to make sure that they're waterproof. It'd be a shame to get some really nice binoculars and not be able to use them very much outside. But the one thing that you want to do is try to get a magnification of at least 8, because a lot of our birds are tiny or way far in the distance, and so it's a lot easier to see them with higher magnification.
Thank you, Brenda. I've been talking to Brenda Wright, Juneau Audubon Society. She's on the board. But the bird walk starts at 8 o'clock on Saturday at Sheep Creek. How do people get in touch with you if you have questions?
You can send a note to me through the programs at the Juneau Audubon webpage, or call me at 321-4739.
Brenda, thanks for coming down today.
Thanks, Jeff.
This is Bird Note. Ravens are common in much of western and northern North America. They were common, too, when European settlers arrived on the Atlantic coast. But the species gradually died out as human activity grew more obtrusive. And through most of the 1900s, ravens were relatively rare in the east.
Their raucous croaks and rattles and toots could be heard only in the wildest parts of the Appalachians. But something changed around the dawn of the 21st century. The ravens came back, first to the reforested hills, then to the wooded suburbs, and now to the steel and concrete of some of our biggest cities. Ravens patrol the parking lots of grocery stores in New Jersey, waddling through the hordes of gulls and crows to seize the choicest trash. They dodge speeding cars on busy turnpikes to scavenge roadkill from the median and the shoulders, and playfully terrorize lapdogs in suburban backyards. Ravens have even colonized the man-made canyons of Manhattan, where their acrobatic flight and coarse, cheerful calls can make even the most hardened city dweller look up in awe. And remember, gratefully, that sometimes the wild can come back. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
It's 32 minutes past the hour in New York. Tune in to June Afternoon. Our next guest in the studio is Donnie Burris from Zach Gordon Youth Center. Donnie, thanks for coming by today.
Thanks for having me.
So what's happening at the center?
So I just wanted to come and update everyone on our 2017 summer camps at Zach Gordon Youth Center. We have some spaces still available, and I'm a parent, and I know I've talked to plenty who are still looking for things for their kids to do this summer. So I just wanted to come in and talk about some of the camps that we have that still have spaces. So I guess I can just go ahead and get started with that.
Please do.
Yes. So we have our Hike Juno camp, and that is June 5th through 9th. All of our camps are 1 to 4:30 for kids ages 8 to 12, and they're $95 a week. Our Hike Juno camp is up first, and that's the June 5th through 9th. On that camp, we're going to tackle different places around Juno. We'll probably hike the tram and Perseverance, and we'll go out to North Douglas. We might do something in Douglas. We'll just go out and have a great time and do some hiking and just spend time together. So we have 7 spaces there, and so all of you parents looking for something to do, June 5th through 9th, we still have space in our Hike Juno camp.
What about age?
Our ages are 8 to 12. So all of the camps I talked about today are 8 to 12, and the camps are from 1 to 4:30. Drop-off is at Zach Gordon Youth Center. And we load the kids up in our van and we go and we explore Juno every day. We also have a Bugs and Birds of Southeast. That's a new camp this year. We're really excited to do that. Actually, that curriculum was also used with the band program. So we're really excited to get out and explore bugs and birds around Juno. We're going to just take a look at what birds live here, what bugs live here, how they live, what they might eat. We're going to do some exploring, and no bugs or birds will be harmed in our camp. We're really excited about that. That's June 12th through 6th. Also, all of the camps, if you're wondering, you guys can come down to Zach Gordon Youth Center. We have the registrations there, or you can go on to juno.org/youthcenter. And you can also get the descriptions and also what camps we have available. We also have a spectacular sandcastle camp, one of my favorites. And that one, we go out to Sandy Beach and Eagle Beach, and we have sandcastle challenges. So we do like 3-tier sandcastles. We do who can make the most moats on their sandcastle. We even do like hidden chambers, like the most spectacular sandcastles. So that's always very fun. We have a tidal wave camp. That camp is full of water fun. So we do swimming at both pools. We'll do some tide pooling. We do some fishing. It's just, we do water balloon fights. What kid doesn't want to do water balloon fights? And it's perfect here in Juneau because most likely it'll be raining, so we'll already be wet. And we just still have fun with water, which is great. We also have space left in our awesome art camp, and that is arts around town. We get in a van and we go to different places. We go to Eagle Beach. We go out to Thane. We go out to North Douglas. We go everywhere and we just paint the scenery. It's really fun. We bring paint on the go, chalk, pencils, crayons, markers, and we just get out there and we just paint what we see. We also do some like wind chimes, so we paint rocks and we just have fun with Awesome Arts. It's another great camp that we still have space in. And also new this year, where we still have a couple spaces left, is our Gather and Harvest Camp. And that is a new one this year, and we're so excited to do this, and we hope to go out and really take advantage of all the nice things growing in Alaska, all the nice edibles, especially the berries, salmon berries and blueberries. I know I myself can't wait to pick blueberries this year. So that's another camp we have space for, and we're just ready to fill these camps, ready to entertain your kids and just have a great time this summer.
You know me at the Zach Gordon Youth Center?
Yeah, so every camp meets at Zach Gordon Youth Center. And at 1 o'clock, we hop in a van and we go out and we explore Juneau. We're so fortunate to live here, and it's so beautiful, and there's so many things to do. And so when you get a bunch of kids together and a couple of camp counselors, it's just really amazing. You just go out and have so much fun. The camps are from 1 to 4:30. And again, they're for ages 8 to 12. They're $95 per week, which is really a great deal here in Juneau. And they're Monday through Friday. We do have one four-day camp, and that's the Exploring Eagle Valley Camp. That camp is 4 days because of 4th of July holiday. And that camp is also our only all-day camp. So that camp is from 9 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. And we go out to Eagle Valley, and we just explore. There's lots of cool little bodies of water over there, and we go and we build rafts and floats, and we play a lot of capture the flag, and we do some hiking. So all of our camps, you can definitely expect to do some hiking. You can expect to have some fun, and you can definitely expect to just enjoy time with friends. So it's very great.
All right, sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add?
Oh, yeah. So if you guys are interested in any of these camps, please don't hesitate to come down to Zach Gordon Youth Center. We're in the same parking lot as Centennial Hall and the Jack. We're open from 11 to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday. And on Friday, we close at 10. And on Saturday, we're open 3 to 10. You can come down and register. We'll be happy to help you out. And if you just want to read about the classes, be sure to go online to juneau.org/youthcenter. There you can find the classes, the prices, the times, and also descriptions of the camps. And if you have any other questions, please feel free to call us at 586-2635.
Johnny Burris, thank you for coming down today.
Thanks for having me.
If you don't like going to the dentist, it's probably because it was a bad experience for you as a child. Times have changed. The board-certified pediatric dentist at the New Search Children's Dental Clinic will explain things in a way your child understands and provide fun distractions. Kids will actually want to go to the dentist and want to take care of their teeth throughout their lives. The New Children's Dental Clinic at Search is proud to offer pediatric dental services to all Juneau's kids. To make an appointment for your child, call 789-KIDS.
There's something new in the air. It's a little soul, it's a little jazz, and it's a little bit more. And hey, this is Nod here, and I'm here every Friday night from 9 to 11. Won't you join me for Far True Radio, and I promise you, you'll be glad you did. Friday nights at 9 p.m., KRNN-FM.
Juneau's bronze whale sculpture. In this installment of Curious Juneau, we try to answer a common question about the city's decision to place a prominent piece of art so far from downtown. KTOO's Jacob Resnick has more.
Aaron Woodrow is a commercial fisherman in Juneau. Often he can be found selling fresh seafood off the side of his 38-foot boat in Harris Harbor.
I drive up and down the channel a lot fishing, and so I see the whale as I go by, and when I'm coming in, you can't really see it with the naked eye until you're just about to it.
Which leads the mariner to wonder
why the city chose to put the whale sculpture in a location that seems to be visible from the bridge or Douglas Breezin parking lot. I think most people seem to think that it was going to go up on the island that was being constructed, where it would have been visible from the highway. unless you have binoculars when you're coming up the channel, you wouldn't even know it's there.
To try and answer Mr. Woodrow's question, I paid a visit to the city's engineering department.
Well, there's always a lot of questions, and obviously how it ended up there was a long process.
That's Sky Steckel, a city engineer. The original Whale Committee had proposed the sculpture to be downtown in Marine Park, but the Whale Park isn't just a six-ton piece of bronze that towers 25 feet skyward. There will also be a pool of water around it, so engineers pushed back.
One of the problems we came to when we tried to look at the downtown areas like Marine Park was, you know, the size of the whale. Sure, if it was just the whale by itself, it could fit in, but with the pool infrastructure, it became large enough that it would essentially be the entire Marine Park, and it wouldn't have a lot of usable space.
So how about down near where the cruise ships dock? City Manager Rory Watt headed the engineering department back then. He says,
those areas are already dominated by seasonal tourism, and that would not be a good location for Juneau citizens.
A whale park could get cluttered amid T-shirt shops. So the Whale Committee looked further north.
The other areas on the waterfront are controlled by the Mental Health Trust, and so we didn't control the land. Or there are city tidelands that are not filled and would take a long time to develop. So the bridge park was the best location.
And the artificial island? There are no utilities out there. Running power and water lines could get expensive, not to mention it would need more permits from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. It turns out there isn't as much free space on Juneau's waterfront as one might imagine. Artist R.T. Skip Wallen is a guy who sculpted the whale. He spoke by phone from a studio in Florida.
I think it's a good site. This sculpture requires some room. Because it's so tall, it requires space enough around it so that people can get back a bit from it. So it can't really be shoehorned into a small space.
Then there's another consideration, lighting.
Because the sun arcs up over Douglas Island, items on the waterfront tend to be backlighted. And in its current site, in the early morning and again in the late afternoon, the whale gets some light on its front face, the side that most people will be viewing.
The city is being sued by the cruise ship industry over its use of marine passenger fees for the Seawalk and the Whale Park. That's still playing out in federal court. And the Whale Park site is still mostly a muddy building site. Work is progressing slowly around the solitary humpback whale sculpture. Portions of the Seawalk should be opening in coming weeks, though the whole park, with its elaborate water features, won't be ready until next spring. No public funds went into the whale sculpture. It was paid for through donations. There is sales tax and marine passenger fee money going into the infrastructure around it, so Juneau taxpayers and cruise ship passengers are paying for much of the project. I press Aaron Woodrow a bit to see if he's just a whale hater.
But you do like the sculpture itself, though.
Oh, I think the whale sculpture is awesome. I don't think anybody would deny that it's a pretty amazing piece of art, but I think they could have chose a better location for it.
The city staff is appealing for patience for when it's finally done. Here's Rory Watt.
I think when we're finished, people are really going to enjoy it, and they're going to forget there ever was a controversy.
Optimistic talk from a city manager. We'll check back in a year's time. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
That's all for this Curious Juno. To ask your own question, to read this or other stories online, go to ktoo.org/curious.
Our next speaker is Pete Griffin, and Pete moved to Juneau in 1999, and he never left. He retired from the Forest Service in 2010 and spends his time fishing, hunting, and searching for audiences that will listen to his stories. Each summer for the past 6 years, Pete has entertained passengers on board Disney and Princess cruise ships with stories about living off the land, glaciers, and animals found in Alaska. His most recent project is a one-man performance, Diary of a Forest Ranger, filmed at 360 North and broadcast statewide last year. Please help me welcome Pete to the stage.
So in 1980, I'm a young wildlife biologist working for the Forest Service in Michigan, and I am worried about an endangered species. The Kirtland's warblers, only 400 of these birds left in the whole world. And they nest in just across a few counties in northern lower Michigan. No, the problem with this bird is it nests in stands of young jack pine. Now, jack pine is a species of a tree that requires a fire for it to reproduce. Its cones are so hard, they do not open up until the forest burns in a forest fire so intense that it kills the trees, but the cones will open up and the seeds will drop onto the ground and a new stand of jack pine is born. And that's where the warblers nest, but we can't tolerate the risk of forest fires anymore. The threats to life and property are too great. Forest Service in the state of Michigan have done a good job in eliminating forest fires from the ecosystem, and as a result, the bird is on the brink of extinction. But we have a plan. We clear-cut large areas of jack pine for pulpwood, leaving the tops and the branches in these large clear-cuts, and then when the weather is just right, we go out and we burn these clear-cuts. The limbs and the tops burn up, the cones open, drop the seeds, and the warblers can nest there again. But we're falling way behind on our goals, way behind. And I know what the problem is. The problem is the Forest Service isn't committed. Oh, the weather's not right. Oh, we don't want to pay overtime. Oh, the bulldozer's broken down. The bird's going extinct. But on the morning of May 5th, 1980, conditions seemed just perfect. They start a fire on a 200-acre Crane Lake unit, and the fire is burning very nicely across the middle of the unit. Flame lengths are about a foot and a half high, and it's doing very nicely. And then the fire burns into several piles of slash near the fire control line. And the fire goes 5, 10, 15 feet up, and a smoke and column carries embers over the fire line, starting spot fires on outside the fire line. But that's expected. We have crews there to take care of that, to put those out. My friend Jim is on the dozer, and his job is to locate those fires with his bulldozer, drop his fire plow, and plow a line around these little spot fires, and hand crews can put them out. But there's spot fires here, and there's spot fires there, and there's spot fires over there. There are so many, and then a spot fire starts in a stand of very short jack pine. And the trees erupt in flames, and those flames are carried up into the tops of the mature jack pine. And a crown fire starts, and a column of smoke builds 1,000 feet, 2,000 feet, carries embers over the state highway 100 yards to the east. Now, folks who have been around crown fires will tell you it's like standing next to the railroad tracks when a freight train rolls by. The air pulses and there's a roar and you can almost feel the ground shake. You're being sucked into it. When a crown fire starts, there's nothing a human being can do to put it out. But Jim takes his dozer across the state highway, starts putting in a line on the other side, drops his fire plow, and he chases the fire, and the wind swirls, and Jim disappears into the smoke of what has become the Mack Lake fire. Now, while all this is going on, I'm 90 miles away at work, and I hear rumors of a big fire in Mile, and at the end of the day, I go home, I turn on my black and white television, and there's a banner growing across the bottom of the screen. The Oscoda County Sheriff's Department requests all available personnel and heavy equipment to report to Mile to battle a forest fire that's burned thousands of acres, 40 homes, and resulted in one fatality. Within minutes, I get a call from my supervisor, Pete, get your fire gear together. We send in a crew to Mile. So I pull on my green fire pants and my yellow fire shirt, gather my fire gear, and I head for the office, and I join a crowd of quiet firefighters standing in the parking lot in the twilight. I see Cliff, the fire staff officer, and I go up to him, Cliff, who died? His face is a mask when he turns to me. Jim Swiderski, he says. Jim? Well, that can't be right. Well, Jim and I are both young wildlife biologists. We had just gotten together at a meeting just a couple of months ago. We talked about how things would be different with the wildlife program if we were in charge. We compare notes on how much fun it is operating a bulldozer on the fire line. Jim, that can't be right. People don't die in forest fires in Michigan. Well, the next morning I'm on the fire line. It's green on one side, black on the other, and I wander out into the black. There's no fire left. Tendrils of smoke curl up from the ground. I stand among the blackened skeletons of jack pine. Branches arch toward a blue sky, and in the tops of those branches, I see cones that have opened. And I look on the ground, and there are seeds scattered all over the ground. By the next spring rain, those seeds will germinate. Kirtland's warblers will nest here. Well, there's an investigation. Things went wrong. Mistakes were made, and every mistake compounded the results of the mistakes made before. I know if I'd been in charge that morning, I would have started that fire too. If I had been on that bulldozer, I would have done the same things that Jim had done. Well, 7 years later, the first warblers nested in the Mack Lake burn. 20 years later, there's 1,000 birds. 30 years later, there's 4,000 Kirtland's warblers and are no longer on the brink of extinction, and that's a good thing. But today, I ask myself the same question I did standing in the black of the Mack Lake fire. Is saving a species from extinction worth the price of a young man's life?
That's Pete Griffin, recorded April 11th, 2017, as part of the Mudroom series. Reminder that the bird walk is this Saturday, 8 a.m. at Sheep Creek. The hike for tomorrow is the Winfield Lake Trail, located just before the Herbert River. Walk the gravel road to the cul-de-sac, where the trail begins to the right. It's an easy hike of 8.5 miles round trip, ending at the heated cabin on Winfield Lake. You should wear waterproof hiking boots and clothing, bring food and water. Meet at the parking lot at 27th, ready to hike at 9:30 in the morning. Carpooling is encouraged. No dogs or firearms, please, and have a great hike.
this is Chris Thiele, the host of A Prairie Home Companion. Won't you join me each weekend as we celebrate the magic of radio? It's perfect for watching the glaciers move, and I suspect you'll have a capital time. Tune in every Saturday afternoon at 4 on KTOO News, Juno, and repeated Sunday mornings at 11 on KRNN-FM.
The forecast for Saturday, areas of fog before 10 a.m. in the morning. Otherwise, partly sunny skies with high temperatures near 63 degrees. Forecast for Sunday, mostly sunny skies with high temperatures near 67 degrees. Forecast for Memorial Day, partly sunny skies with high temperatures near 68 degrees. Thank you.